Welcome, this is William Evans and we're shifting gears. Our guest today is Bryant Austin. And Bryant Austin is a photographer and we're sitting in a park in Santa Fe where he's had a major show of his photography. Thank you for talking with us, Bryant.
That's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bryant, tell me about how you learned about whales.
Probably the time I learned about whales was when I first saw dolphins in captivity, and I didn't even know what they were. I didn't know what a dolphin was. And I just saw a very evident suffering. They were in a touch tank. It was very filthy, muddy water, you know, browned, covered in scratches, and they're just barely breathing at the surface, and kids were screaming and yelling and slapping the water. And I just was surrounded by people that seemed oblivious to their suffering, and I was only 6 years old, I think, 5 or 6 years old at the time. And so I didn't know what a dolphin was or a cetacean, which are whales, dolphins, porpoises, but I knew suffering. And I remember just kind of being in a stupor at this marine park for another hour. Then I just went into a rage, and my mom had to take me home. Like, I just did not want to be there. I don't even think I was in touch with the rage. I just released all this anger.
Wow.
Tantrum.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was like the very first, you know, inklings of that connection. And it took a long time to wake up to that connection. So I had to build a lot of confidence and self-esteem, which I didn't have when I was young. And it took a long time. It took probably, it took another 30 years to build up the confidence and self-esteem to really take on the subject of a whale.
So it took 30 years for you to accept and be comfortable with the gift of communication that you were able to receive from the dolphin.
Yeah, just having that undeniable connection, like whatever that is. If I ignore it, I get really depressed. I've been suicidal, hospitalized, trying to ignore it. Ultimately, in therapy, I learned I have to. This is my truth, and I need to listen to it, or I'm gonna die young. You know, and my psychiatrist warned me I could have a heart attack or take my own life, and that was in 2006, and so I've been doing this full time ever since.
Talk about the next time you were with a cetacean.
Oh, after that moment as a child?
Right.
Yeah. So I've never seen him in the wild. I saw him in captivity that one time, and then it wasn't until I was 21 years old, and my dad exposed me to sea kayaking, and it's something that really made sense for me because I'm a solitary person, and I like to get away from people. I love to be in nature, and sea kayaking is a great way to do that. And so he took me on my first sea kayaking trip to British Columbia, to Johnstone Strait, which is the inside passage in a very popular area for seeing killer whales. And so that was the first time I saw a wild cetacean. And there was a moment, we were in a two-person kayak, where they were swimming up to us in our direction, and we just stopped, and they went around us and under us, and I could see the bottom. It was clear water, so I could see the rocks on the bottom, and I could see this entire killer whale go right under us and vocalize at the same time, so it resonated through the hull of the kayak like a guitar would, like how that sound space would amplify the sound. And we followed them for a little bit, and they stopped to chase salmon into rock cracks. We stopped to observe them chasing salmon, and at one point one spy hopped and looked at us, and they went from like a cute sea panda, like a big intimidating sea panda, to when you saw the eye, they were just completely transformed. You know, there was something there studying you. And yeah, that changed my life.
And then what happened?
At the same time that happened, I was taking what I call big medicine to overcome feeling less than human, having no self-esteem, no confidence, and being completely out of touch with my truth and acting upon the things that, you know, resonate with me, things that excite me. The big medicine for me was my friend and mentor, Jonathan, taught me the sport of base jumping. And so I was a very shy kid. I was afraid to jump off a 20-foot cliff into the river. And so I don't know what took over me, but I almost felt like I was just channeling something, and it was something I had to do. And so we did that for about 3 years.
You did that in Yosemite?
Yosemite, yeah. Arizona, all over California. And it was big medicine, and he was such an inspiration. It gave me so much confidence to look at the world in wonder and not be afraid, or be less afraid. I still have fear. But look at the world and look at what moves you and what you want to act upon with less fear. And you can just look at the world in wonder, you know, and get closer to that state. And that's the state he was in. He really had no judgments or no counterpoint to, like, your dreams, you know. It was like, how do you do that? You need to do that. You know, it was just very encouraging, very empowering. And so that was my big medicine. But it's not sustainable, although it's transformative. If you jump long enough, you'll eventually injure yourself, get arrested, or die. And so Jonathan passed away in 1993, and I was there in the little Colorado River Gorge in Arizona. And so I decided I could no longer risk my life for fun, that I would only put my life at risk for a worthy cause. And a year later, I swam with my first whale in the Azores. And then 6 months after that, I was volunteering full-time for a whale conservation organization for a year.
And talk about those whale experiences during that time.
The first time I got in the water, that was 1994. The thing that's interesting is when Jonathan passed away, and another dear friend passed away, Steve McElwain, who was a base jumper, he died of stomach cancer. They were the magic that made it really worthwhile. And the base jumpers that were left that I jumped with for another year would tell me why I couldn't swim with whales. Like, you can't do that. You know, it's against the law. You need permits. And I thought to myself, who are these people? like, what am I doing? You know, the magic's gone. So I stopped. And a year after Jonathan died, I was with the whales in the Azores. There was no internet back then. And so my only access to the ocean world, especially the ocean world as it's studied, as it's looked at as a form of artistic study, was a magazine called Ocean Realm. And I don't think it's not around anymore. It was very expensive, beautiful publication, but I don't think it was sustainable. But God, it was beautiful. I saw a small press release in there about a man who does guided trips to swim with whales, and I never heard of such a thing. And I was so excited, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I was euphoric. And I immediately called the travel agency that coordinates all this for him, and they sent me a stack of brochures. It's just colored paper with printouts. It was very basic, and I saw all the places all over the world that they would go. I couldn't believe it. And so I signed up, and the Azores was the first trip I had done. And it was on a liveaboard sailboat for just, I think, 10 or 11 days. We sailed with two biologists, sperm whale biologists in the Azores, and I had a few opportunities to swim with the whales and really see a lot. It really opened my mind. It was the first time I left the country. It was the second time, and probably the second time I've been on a commercial plane, even though I was jumping out of planes skydiving for years. I'd never been in a commercial plane.
And you were how old?
I was 25.
And so, from the age 6 to 25, the significant episode of trusting yourself was the base jumping.
Yeah.
And then you trust yourself in this, I would interpret it as a calling from the whales, and you could hear it.
Yeah, I've had dreams. Before base jumping, I had a dream about whales in the night. Ever since then, that led to a spark of just base jumping and everything else.
And did Jonathan die base jumping?
Yeah.
What did you experience at a communication trust level the first time you swam with the whales?
I think I was just too overwhelmed. And initially, I bought a camera, and you know they were the biologists saying you really don't even worry about the camera because when you first see them you're not going to believe it and you're going to it's going to be overwhelming. And I was like, you know, I've done some pretty crazy things. I think I'll be fine. And sure enough, we got in the water and a couple of females swam by us, and I forgot about the camera. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was so overwhelming. And there is sort of this subconscious trust. You don't even think about it. There are times they do worry me, and I know what behaviors to avoid, but you know, that was 1994, and I wouldn't swim with another whale till 2004. So I did that trip in the Azores, and then my childhood hero, Paul Watson, they accepted my application to volunteer with their organization. So
that organization is?
Oh, Sea Shepherd Conservation Society.
Right.
And they're very known for extreme, you know, enforcement of international laws to protect whales and dolphins. And you know, it was important that I did that, because at the end it was very disillusioned at the end of that year. You know, I guess childhood heroes can often let you down, you know,
yeah,
because we project a lot on them. But it was very educational. I think it was really important. And but at the same time, it really burned me out. It took a couple of years to recover from that. And I recovered by learning sea kayaking, like making a real effort to learn, and kayaking on the ocean every weekend for 2 years.
In Monterey Bay.
Mm-hmm. All over California, from Humboldt to L.A. And then I eventually moved to Santa Cruz.
And then, do I remember right, it was 2004 when you began to swim again?
Yeah.
Whales.
Yeah. So I think, you know, to back up just a little bit, so I was burned out and kayaked and had a job opportunity in Santa Cruz to be close to the ocean. And by 1998, I realized the only thing I really want to do is commune with marine mammals and study them, you know, creatively, and to explore the aesthetics of them and their environment. And so I said, you know, just do that. Don't have an agenda. Just explore. And so I did that, and it started from photographing sea otters from a kayak to ultimately getting a 6-meter rigid hull inflatable boat that guy can go far offshore with. And we photographed whales and dolphins above water for a couple of years. And then by 2004, I had been doing it for 2 years, and I had nothing, no photographs. So if you can imagine, I mean, you're trying to bring together, you're trying to find whales and dolphins and align that their behavior up with evocative conditions, sea states, surface states, how it reflects atmospheric states, and really bringing it together in a really evocative way. And so 2 years I had nothing, and I was just going deep into debt. And so the show here, I've been working 2.5 years, and I've made almost 70 photographs already. So it's just so different. And
I read the realization that helped you make the transition from photographing whales to working in Yosemite.
Yeah, and having access to your subject every day.
Right.
It's very important. So I signed up to go to Tonga to swim with humpback whales in 2004, but I was so... I felt I had made a mistake, like that this whole thing was a mistake. You know, I spent a lot of money to looking for these elusive moments to share with humanity. I mean, from the boat, the expenses with the boat, I had the first autofocus medium format camera made by Hasselblad. I was living in a trailer at where I worked. Yeah, I worked at a sea otter research lab, and and just really sacrificed everything. Sacrificed my first marriage. It just caused a lot of stress, and I was just beginning to feel a lot of regret. And it was too late to refund my trip to Tonga. I didn't want to go. I just wanted to quit everything and rebuild my life. And so I went reluctantly, and that's what changed me, though. That was everything. And
talk about what you experienced, particularly in the context of trust. And what I heard and saw from my research just before I came,
yeah,
was that you had a level of comfort with yourself, mm-hmm, and that allowed you to be patient and comfortable with the whales,
yeah,
as they figured out you were okay to approach.
Yeah. Yeah, the one thing I do with whales is I just give them complete space, because they're very curious by nature, and you've got to give them space to let them explore their natural curiosity. And so that's very at the core of it. And people often say I'm very patient, but I realized during this show that it's not patience. It's my truth. I'm in complete harmony with my purpose, and so there's no resistance. So when you're in perfect alignment with your truth, there's no resistance. So patience doesn't even enter into it. You're just there's no resistance, and you're completely there in the moment.
What I hear you telling me is that you've realized just during this show here,
yeah,
in Santa Fe,
yeah,
that your truth is inherent trust.
Yeah, yeah, and it's true with the sun and all the work I've done. Like when this event happens that I've waited 6 months or a year for, and my camera jams, and by the time I reboot my camera, the moment's gone, that even then there's no patience. There's no losing, getting impatient or resisting. It's okay. Like this is my flow. This is my truth. There's no resistance. And I don't know how else to describe it. But, if I'm in traffic or in my computer, I get the wheel of death on my computer, then I start to get impatient, So.
Well, there's so much confusion and lack of trust,
mm-hmm,
in the world we live in right now, and
I know
a lack of truth.
Right.
So that people don't know who to believe or what to believe, and that becomes a paralyzing, desperate state.
Really bad right now. There's no regulation on dissemination of news now. It's just a free-for-all.
And so you're anchored in a very unforgettable and profound experience with realizing you go into sacred time when you're with the whales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the clock doesn't have anything to do with what's happening.
No, I mean, and clock time's an illusion anyway, and it really melts away when I'm with them or with other subjects that really resonate with me.
So that's a scarce experience for particularly males in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's critical to making life-sustaining choices.
Right, right. Yeah, for me, my life-sustaining choice wasn't a monetary one. I don't let that, no matter how stressful it might feel, like I never let that govern my decisions as an artist, and really as someone who wants to thrive and stay alive and thrive. And I think when you do that, you it's rough. And you kind of live on the fringe of society. For me, I was single for 9 years, and I realized it's nothing personal. It's not that I have no value or as a partner, it's just that our values are different. My values are different from most people, most women that would want to have a relationship. But I think that's the first step for me in a sustainable existence is aligning with your truth, your purpose.
Well, it's rare to align with your truth at the level where money doesn't influence your decisions.
I see it ruin so many artists and just so many people's lives. I see it ruin our ecology, our economy. I've had to live with my mom. I've lived in my van, when I had one. I was looking at just being homeless and living in nature, for a while until I could figure things out. But so I understand why it governs our life and kind of takes away our humanity. You really think about literally everything is monetized in this world, and the only thing that's free, that's universal, that we all have access to, is air. And we've got to move away from that or we're in big trouble.
Well, we are in trouble when we don't have the ability to see what I would call the authentic value of ourself and the authentic value of water and nature and Mother Earth, which is a life-sustaining system.
Yes,
that humans have been enjoying and been sustained by Mother Nature,
right,
from the beginning of our standing up and walking. And this kinship with creation is the source of a great deal of joy as well as nourishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've had little regard for our ecology, putting money first, and now it seems like we have little care for our economy, and even that we treat that the way we treat our ecology, in terms of maintaining something sustainable, for civilization.
Well, when a man has a confused heart, he loses his ability to even see sustainable options, life-sustaining choices.
That's a good point.
Because if you see only the economic value, you never get the authentic nourishment. So talk about some of the very direct and tactile experiences with whales and how that grew in you in terms of the realization of their basic nature, who they were and what kind of creatures they are.
First of all, when they come up to you and really study you, there's no words for them anymore. Whale is a really meaningless word to describe them, and I wish people could experience that, because I think it would radically change our perception of this world and the cosmos, put to rest our feelings of feeling alone in the cosmos. Are we alone? It's like, no, we're not. That word just melts away. They're to me, they're, when they study me, they're clearly conscious. There's a high intelligence there that we can't measure yet. So, we can speculate, but you certainly experience something when they're studying you. And I've had a 2-week-old humpback whale calf come up to me closer than you and I are now, probably, I would dare say, 2 feet, maybe 30 inches. It was close. But this is a newborn. And you look at a newborn human, and this whale came up to me so close, and I had poor form at the time. I was still learning. This was early, and I was vertical in the water. You're supposed to be flat. So their pectoral fins and their fluke will go under you, or at least you have that option. His pectoral fin touched my leg and he spun me around. And his fluke, the leading edge of his fluke, was aiming for my back. And he could have really seriously hurt me. And he just gently moved it out of the way as he went around me with great care.
Moved the fluke?
Yeah, moved it around.
And so he avoided you?
Yeah, and I've seen many examples of this, that you're talking a newborn with a high awareness, probably building, again, this is all speculation, but just from my intuition being with them for so much time is that they may have memories of being in the fetus. If they're that conscious at just a few days old, I mean, they have to be conscious to breathe. They don't breathe automatically. And they may have memories of being in the fetus and hearing mom vocalize and hearing the males sing and acquiring knowledge. And the womb is a saline environment and it's dark, and they often give birth at night. So to think of that transition from one saline environment to another in darkness, and really to have memories, I don't know if they do, it's all speculation, but I see it very likely that they could have memories in the womb and that transition out, and exhibiting great care and awareness of their environment, of being safe and not harming us. They still can. They're big and they're still learning, and they can play rough with you, and you got to be careful. But they're still. I've seen them just exercise great care, and that blows me away. And I'm really afraid we're going to lose that in our lifetime now. I think
lose
that consciousness, that those whales, we're going to lose them, and we're never going to know what we've lost. And at the same time, the tools are emerging that will allow us to make contact with them. Quantum computing, artificial intelligence will all give us the ability to understand how they communicate, because I don't think we're smart enough. So yeah, I would hope that we can make contact before they go extinct. Because you're talking about, especially with sperm whales and killer whales, these are the largest brains on Earth that have ever existed, and they have documented culture, communication.
Community.
Yeah, tight family groups. And they've been shaping this culture for 8 million years. And to lose that and never know what we lost is that's what drove me in that work, even though I had to take a break from it. But that's always the thing that was on my mind, and wanting to share that message with as many people as I can all over the world.
So the real hope for that is to remember who we are.
Sure.
And our ability to connect and communicate with awareness and kindness rather than killing them.
Yeah, I think connecting to more that is on Earth, more life, connecting, you realize you start to see the divisions we create in our mind, that our culture creates, that we're separate, that we're superior, on the hierarchy, we're up here, the more you connect, the more you realize how foolish that is, and you start to feel more calm and peaceful, though, at the same time.
A friend who plays with animals helped me realize the extent to which I was brainwashed in contest behavior. And so it sounds like you haven't talked to me about your experience with that process, but it might be relevant to talk about what happened as you were educated and conditioned in contest behavior. How did you deal with that, and how did you escape it?
I think I understand what that is, but I've never heard it before. Could you give me just a little, elaborate just a little bit? And I think I understand, though.
What I mean by contest behavior?
Yeah.
An example would be the conversation we're having.
Right.
I'm very comfortable listening to you, and you seem to be able to hear my questions. But what I'm doing is I'm giving you the freedom to be who you are. And if I'm interrupting you or trying to tell you what I see and not listen to you, or I'm lacking in self-esteem, so I want to make you small or wrong, or control you in some way.
I understand now.
That would be the agenda of a lot of organizations that have a lot of power in a dominating way over life on Earth, including human beings, because they would prefer that you follow orders rather than have the level of autonomy and independence you have to build this and recognize the communication and the trust that exist with whales as well as yourself.
Yeah.
So males are particularly vulnerable to that.
Yeah.
Talk about how you understand what was done to you in school and whatever you did athletically. How you make peace with it now.
You know, with school, my mom was very restless, so we moved every 2 years. So I went to a different school in the same city.
Were you raised by your mom?
Yeah. My mom divorced. Dad divorced when I was five.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was a kind of a chubby, red-haired kid, really teased and ridiculed everywhere I went. I got into a lot of fights. And I just began to feel less than human. And I withdrew and just connected with nature more back then. I never played sports. I never had a chance to really become proficient at anything to build self-esteem. The sports I love, I discovered much later, and they're not competitive. They're just, you have to be really good at them, and they're more for personal growth. That's free diving, and then base jumping was the other one, and kayaking.
And your father was the one who introduced you to sea kayaking.
He introduced me to sea kayaking. My dad was a free diver in the 60s. He told me about it. We never dived together, but it's a big part of my life, as well as photography. He was a professional photographer for a while, but never introduced me to it or even talked about it with me much, but it's a big part of my life, you know, so I feel, you know, my dad passed away several years ago, but I always felt like I'm living the life that he wanted. You know, he was very restless like me. He had difficulty tuning into his truth, and he never found his truth, and that restlessness never found its way out, and he became an alcoholic and just a very heavy drinker, and really had a lot of regrets, and I feel like I'm living the life that he always wanted to live, and it was grateful that I'm grateful that he could see me succeed reasonably, you know, and I know that at least we made it together that way, you know.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, and the contest behavior, that's interesting, you know, having own view of the world and my own value systems, they were starting to develop in my teens and 20s. It was very fragile, and then I had no friends to share it with. And the times I would share with my friend, it was very much a point-counterpoint discussion, and I had no confidence. So I would literally, my heart would race, I would sweat. I could feel my amygdala just firing up, trying to protect me. I didn't know what to do, so I would just literally stop. I would end friendships. I would never return calls. I would just shut them out completely because I regret that, but I just didn't know how to. I could definitely have those conversations now, and it's okay if they want to engage in contest behavior. I'll listen, and it wasn't my first real friend, Mark, who was 20 years older than me. He kind of reminded me of Einstein because we met at a data center for the California Franchise Tax Board for the California tax system. So where they store all the files, or the tax returns. And He was a file clerk, but he could easily have taught history at any, you know, military history at any university. He was well versed in physics and so many other areas. Like, he was just really a real Renaissance person and very open and accepting and painfully honest about himself. He would talk about his flaws in a matter-of-fact way, his embarrassing moments in life, in just a very matter-of-fact way. Like, it wasn't ashamed, and it was disarming and allowed me to share my embarrassing moments, my flaws, and we really connected. And that was the first real time that I felt like, wow, this is what a real friendship is.
What's it mean to you to be a man on the earth right now?
That's a big question. I mean, a couple of things about being a man is, first of all, make yourself whole. You know, don't look outside of yourself to complete yourself, whether that's a partner, a friendship, a possession. I feel that's out of control. I think that's a big thing that's missing. If you can achieve that, and not be a slave to your biology, you know, you have a chance for deep, meaningful relationships, either with a partner or friendships. I think that's a big problem. I think my dad, in a way, taught me how not to be. and he became a better person when he became sober, but he taught me how not to be. And that's
he gave you some behavior you could look at and learn from.
Learn from, yeah. And I thought I knew it all, and then I made my own mistakes and then learned, okay, now I still need to course correct. I think, too, going back to, men and women, but, you know, men are more destructive than women. You know, I think men are just, more volatile and destructive overall. And I think when you couple all those, when you're empty, when you're not complete and you're looking outside for completion, the thing that's dangerous is our monetary system. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. The quest for money, the quest to hoard. And I think that's because we don't feel safe. We don't feel secure. And subconsciously, the more digits we have on that piece of paper and for our account, the safer we feel. And that's an illusion. I mean, there is an amount that would be good so you can survive and be comfortable, but beyond that, it's hoarding. And I think because we look for that for security and to feel safe and maybe to feel desirable, perhaps, and for our self-esteem. So again, that's another external thing, and I think it wrecks our humanity. It wrecks civilization's chance for survival and being resilient and able to survive bumps that are coming. I guess that's my short answer.
Well, I would agree. I think that when trust of the number of zeros in my account,
right,
preoccupies my activity and my energy, my trust in the life-sustaining earth and the exchanges I make evaporates. I can't trust both.
Right.
I have to, first of all, have life-sustaining connections and conversations, and then organize myself enough to have enough zeros to
right.
make the trip to Santa Fe.
I appreciate that. Completing that first objective first, and then worrying about the zeros second, you know, to get yourself in a right alignment, you know.
So, let's go back to whales.
Yeah.
And you're listening to KDNK. This is Shifting Gears, and we're in a conversation with Bryant Austin, a photographer, and particularly we're talking with him about his experience making friends with whales, being comfortable with them, and their being comfortable with him, and the photographs that resulted from that experience. So tell me about the physical encounters and the Were you snorkeling with the whales mostly?
Yeah, it's a monsnorkel. Whales don't like bubbles, and when you use a snorkel, you can get in and out of the water quickly, up to 20 times a day, because I'm usually on the water for 10 hours. So you get in and out of the water rapidly to assess behavior and to see if it's a safe behavior, to see how they respond to you. And so there's that, too.
So when you say in and out of the water, you're going to the surface and observing from up there?
Oh, I'm in the boat, so
okay.
I'll leave the boat momentarily to look around, see what they're doing, and then I may stay with them. I work alone with them. They're more likely to come up to you if you're by yourself. The snorkel, free diving is is my passion, so it just makes more sense. Scuba creates a lot of bubbles. Bubbles are a threat display to whales and dolphins, and they're just very cumbersome. It's like wearing a spacesuit. We're aquatic animals. We don't need it.
So talk about some of the physical interaction that you experienced that led to, and tell us where it led in terms of the quality and the kind of photography you're doing with whales when you do that.
Yeah, you know, I'd spent years photographing whales above water. I had a boat dedicated to that purpose and a team of volunteers, and we spent years trying to align cetacean behavior with really evocative sea surface states and atmospheric conditions and light. And I never achieved anything during that four-year period. And photographing them underwater, I was at a complete loss. I had no inspiration to photograph them underwater because I would never swim up to them to get close. That didn't even enter into my mind as a possibility. So I just thought, why take more photos of them underwater that are derivative, you know, and unoriginal and aren't going to move the needle for humanity? So it wasn't until I was in Tonga in 2004 and I reluctantly went to swim with them underwater. And I really didn't want to go because I had just gone, you know, really deep in depth photographing them above water, you know, 4 years and really no photographs. It was a bit maddening. And so in 2004, when I reluctantly made that decision to swim with them, that's when I received the inspiration from them. That's when I saw what was possible.
And to be clear about what you saw was possible, you saw the opportunity to photograph them at a very close distance.
Yeah, they came up to me, and that's never happened before. They came up to me probably 3 feet away. So close that, you know, I had to put the camera down at the end when this young calf's fluke came right about inches by my mask and probably would have brushed up against my camera had I left it in position. And at that distance, you see their true color. You see their skin and musculature flex over their frame as they power their fluke. You see their eye moving in its socket as they study you, and the parasites crawling on them. So that happened with that calf, and what happened next is just reinforced it. That inspiration was, I felt a tap on my shoulder, and it was too solid to be human, and I just felt dread. I think I knew it was Mom. I had a feeling it was her, and I looked, and she was right behind me, looking at me, and her pectoral fin is 15 feet long and weighs 2 tons. She touched me with the very tip of it. It would be like the tip of your middle finger, and had she touched me with the leading edge of her fluke, she would have broke my back. So she just grazed me just to let me know. She was very gentle, and I was humbled by that. I was physically shaking afterwards, trying to process everything I saw. And that's when I realized that the one thing I could do, the one thing that has never been done before, certainly hasn't been done since, is this idea of making high-resolution, one-to-one, life-size portraits of whales with calm expressions in their eye, very calm, curious expressions, and that comes from when they come up to you. If you swim up to them, they're going to have often an expression of distress, so that's not inspiring. So that's where it started, and I wanted to give that to humanity, and yeah.
How many photographs will go into a composite of a whale?
I have three full-body composites, and the number of photographs range from 15 to 30.
And how long does it take you to put those together and integrate a full life-size whale picture?
It depends. It depends. I have to build a. I have to make a purpose-built computer to handle the file sizes. They're massive. The first one took 2 months to build the computer and then finish the composite.
Okay.
And my last one is 8 by 36 feet. That took 6 months to build the computer, and then 6 months to finish it is my largest file. It was completed in 2012. It's never been printed or finished to museum standards. I spent another from 2012, I spent another 3 years just trying to raise funds to print and mount it to museum standards. And that's when I reluctantly stopped and decided I need to create again. I can't do this.
You realized that you didn't have the financial resources and the time to...
and it was draining me. It was
to do what you could do with whales.
Yeah, it was corrosive to the creative part of my mind, being a salesman every day and not creating. And so I had to take a break, yeah.
But you did get these pictures that you did complete.
Yeah.
To some of the whaling countries.
I did. It wasn't that I thought I could end whaling. What I was really interested in is I wanted to share the work with what I thought would be the most challenging audiences, you know, in countries where the issue of whaling is highly polarized and toxic. And I thought if people were moved here, that this is a worthwhile practice to pursue and really address the real issues. Whaling represents less than 1% of what's killing whales, and what the thing that's killing whales is our lifestyle. Our lifestyle choices are killing whales in record numbers. Our love of seafood, our use of single-use disposable plastic is destroying the ocean. Cheap goods from overseas and the shipping industry that supports it is acidifying our ocean. So those are the issues I really wanted to touch upon, but I initially shared in Norway and Japan just to see how people would respond. And we had incredible attendance, incredible moments with viewers. In Norway, I met with whalers who came to the show. I think the press wanted to kind of stir some controversy and some drama. And the whalers were moved to silence, and we had very respectful conversation. And they couldn't believe how I told them I made the photographs and the trust I had in that creature. You know, they could not believe it.
So you stood there in silence with them?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't believe in polarizing. And I want to listen. I want to give them space. And yeah.
And how long would that space sometimes be?
I'm trying to recall. Be a minute, which feels like a long time.
It can be when you're standing next to someone and neither of you are saying anything.
Yeah, we were just kind of looking at the photographs together.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what would happen?
I just recall just them being silent, just us having a conversation about how they were taken and just seeing the expressions on their face about how I let them come to me so close, you know. Sometimes, like with sperm whales, you know, how their mouth would be open underneath my body and I have to be careful not to let my foot go inside their mouth because they might want to feel it and just touch it. They were shaking their heads. They couldn't believe it. You know, I don't think they look at whales that way. They don't think of them. I'm sure they probably have nightmares about being in the water with them. You know, like, that's the last thing they would want. So it was an interesting experience.
Well, what I hear is that the silence and the spaciousness that you granted to the whales...
Right.
You granted to the whalers.
Yeah, you granted to everybody, yes.
And they glided away and had the experience to process.
Absolutely. If I told them how awful they are to kill whales, how dare they? I'm completely robbing them of their freedom to explore their the emotional spectrum of viewing them in this way. And I think it's I think we're all guilty of that, you know, and it feels good to be self-righteous and judgmental of others, but then you just divide, you know, and you rob that person of their freedom to explore the wide spectrum of possibilities of emotional responses, and you know.
Well, you allow them to find who they are.
That's important.
And you also allow them to find their own way of standing in the world without your interfering with their awakening.
Yeah.
At the end of the TED Talk I watched, you had a lovely quote for us about the heart.
Right.
Can you share that with us?
I'll try to recall. You know, I think it just touches upon, you know, it's really tough for all of us, I think, to listen to our truth and to follow what we love, because we have to monetize and survive with the overhead of life. And we often just compromise, and we're not even in touch with it. We don't even allow ourselves to, we don't even dare explore like what really moves us, because I think it would hurt too much to know that we've been so separate from it for so long. I mean, when I was in Tonga, I discovered my truth there, and on the plane ride home, I was in tears. I was just crying. I was so devastated. I was being just literally just like ripping a tree out of the ground. I just realized that was where you were supposed to be. That was your journey. And you got a glimpse of your truth, and you had not been building a life that led you to a sustainable way to live in your truth. And I think for anyone, you know, when I said, what is your well, you know, what is your truth? I mean, I want that for people, but I also understand why we don't tap into it, because it can be very painful to wake up to it.
I was grateful for an experience where I burst into tears.
Yeah.
And the space that was allowed me, and the long process of discovering what that was about. But there was a phrase that was helpful to me, and that was, when the tears flow, the soul is dancing.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I felt that this week at the show. Especially with the Zuni dancers, I felt like crying, but I didn't. I remember looking up at the photographs while they were dancing, and all the work is created. I'm alone. The entire process is solitary, and seeing them dance, I just realized I'm never alone. You know, it was just a really beautiful feeling, and yeah, I could almost feel, like you said, like the spirit dancing within me, and I felt too shy, I guess, to let it out.
Well, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
This is KDNK. You've been listening to a conversation with Bryant Austin and his experiences learning to be with whales. Thank you for listening.